Hey, y'all, welcome to the show. Boy, is it just me or is The Onion just not funny at all anymore? I wonder, maybe I could just come up with a minute-long collection of sound bites to play for that minute before the show kicks in instead of The Onion news anymore. Was that supposed to be funny? That was supposed to be satire. Ha, 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 ha. You failed again. So, yeah, did you hear that? The Onion says, beauty standards are unrealistic, and maybe if you wear makeup, it'll make you look prettier, ladies. Is that funny? Did anyone laugh at all in that entire minute of Onion crap? Oh, breaking news. I got a mask that looks like a pretty girl for people who aren't pretty to wear because, you know, unrealistic beauty standards. Yeah, great work, guys. I read a thing that said they fired everyone who was funny at The Onion and they brought in a bunch of people who aren't funny. You know, I think maybe they were onto something in that article. Oh, because what happened was they called a young movie starlet the C word. And that was a bridge too far. Which, you know, it's supposed to be satire, guys. But anyway, so they fired everybody who was funny at The Onion. But that's my problem. It's the same with watching the news as watching TV commercials or what's the Onion thing? I always imagine the discussion when they came up with the idea, you know? Like watching The Daily Show or... How did they write that joke? Oh, I know. They must have... They started with unrealistic beauty expectations, and then somebody said, I know, what if we did one where now there's like a mask you could wear, and then the mask looks pretty, and then other people agreed with that. And then they went ahead and produced it. And then for some reason, Ian Freeman included it in the rotating list of Onion news briefs. Maybe he didn't listen first to see whether it was funny or not. Get it? See, because most women aren't stunningly beautiful, only some. And so the ones who aren't, maybe if they wore a mask, then people would think that they're pretty. Sorry, I know. This probably isn't a very interesting episode of the Scott Horton Show either. I just feel like talking about things I hate today. So, a lot of Israel today on the show. Because I hate Israel. The nation state. And at least a bare majority of the population. What a bunch of jerks. What's his name today? Is it Yuri Avner? No, Gideon Levy says Netanyahu deserves the Israeli people and they deserve him. Well, that may be true, but what about the Palestinians? And what about the rest of mankind? Don't we get a vote? Hell, I guess if the Palestinians can't get a vote in the Knesset, the rest of mankind can't either. But we all have to suffer the continued rule of Likud Israel. It's just white supremacy. That's all it is. Anytime anybody says, oh, don't say that, you're an anti-Semite, say, no, you're a white supremacist, and I'm against that kind of thing. You see, the majority, the vast majority of the population of Israel, they're Ashkenazi Jews from Europe. They're white people from Europe. They're not really Israeli at all. They're foreigners. They're immigrants. And they're living on stolen land, and they keep stealing more and more and more all the time. And their excuse is, we're white, and they're not, and so we can. That's their excuse. Here, I'll Google it up for you right now. Here, you help. You use DuckDuckGo or whatever is your favorite brand. Israel is for the white man. Now, do you think it was an Anglo-Saxon Protestant that said that? No, no, of course not. This was Israel's interior ministry, Eli Yishai, when he was explaining why Sudanese and Ethiopian Jews can't come to Israel. Because Israel is for the white man. You see? It's just like the old South under segregation. It's just like apartheid South Africa. Israel is run by the KKK. The Likud party is nothing but the Democratic Party, the Dixiecrat party of Israel. That's all they are. And, well, how else can you interpret their official government policy that Arabs don't have rights? That they're born subhuman without the right to their own life, to their own property? The excuse is they're brown. That's it. Doesn't matter if their families have lived in Palestine for 2,000 years or 3,000. Oh, that doesn't matter. A bunch of white Europeans decided to come and build a colony where a bunch of brown people lived. So? And so that's why it's not even a problem for Benjamin Netanyahu to come right out and renounce his pretension that he ever meant to negotiate for a Palestinian state. The Palestinians, the Christians, the Muslim Palestinian Arabs, they're subhuman, that's all. In the eyes of the Israeli government, they don't have rights. And I love this by Joe Klein, the liberal Zionist, writing for Time Magazine. This is in Time Magazine. Can you believe this quote? In Time Magazine. I know, don't be so damn cynical. Pretend for a minute that you can't believe that he said this. A great many Jews have come to regard Arabs as the rest of the world traditionally regarded Jews. They have had cause. What? Excuse me for a second. I was raised to believe, and I still believe, that anti-Semitism, by definition, is not just morally wrong, but is factually wrong. It's stupid. It's unfair. By definition, it couldn't possibly be right that an entire category of people by religion or ethnicity can be categorized as some enemy population or possessing characteristics that make them a threat to the people that they live near or whatever. Isn't that baked right into the definition of bigotry that it's stupid and unfair and nonsensical? But it's okay for a white Jewish man to write in Time magazine that a great many Jews have come to regard Arabs as the rest of the world traditionally regarded Jews, which he's referring to the very worst aspects of persecution of Jews in the past there, obviously. And then he writes, they have had cause. And now, this is actually a very, very nice article by Joe Klein about how, geez, well, maybe Palestinians are a little bit human, and maybe Netanyahu is going a little too far, and maybe racism isn't A-okay, maybe it's just B-okay. But then he goes on to say indiscriminate rocket attacks. Okay, let's pretend that Hamas started every conflict with Israel that they've been in by shooting their pathetic little bottle rockets over the wall. The total casualty count of one in the last 10 years. That's cause for racist bigotry against all Arabs and Muslims? Really? According to Joe Klein at Time Magazine, sure. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com.
Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, y'all, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm on Liberty Radio Network. Archives are at scotthorton.org. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Yeah, I don't know. Join up the chat room. scotthorton.org/chat. scotthorton.org/chat or hashtag Scott Horton Show. It's IRC free node chat room. Hashtag Scott Horton Show. Hey, guys, how's it going? So, listen, I was watching this documentary earlier this morning. God dang. Oh, now I don't know what it's called because I accidentally closed the tab. I think I retweeted part of it. Let me see if I can find the title for you. It's this American Jewish lady giving a speech explaining the occupation to Americans. Here it goes. It's called Life in Occupied Palestine, a presentation by a Jewish American. And her name is Anna Baltzer. I'll see if I can get her on the show here. And she's talking about how she went and... she, I guess, was living in the Middle East for a long time and started taking vacations around and came to realize what she hadn't been told about the occupation, and particularly in the West Bank here. I don't think she went to Gaza. But she's talking about the occupation in the West Bank, and then she goes through, she breaks it down, and explains about the separation wall. Did you realize, you see those pictures from the Palestinian side of the giant gray concrete wall, you know, 100 feet high or whatever? Well, on the Israeli side, I'd never seen this before, on the Israeli side of the land theft wall, what they do is they use bulldozers to build up the dirt up to the wall so that it looks just like a nice sloping hillside with just a tiny little wall on top. When in fact it's 100 feet high on the other side kind of thing. Anyway, she goes through, she explains how the people of the West Bank are slaves. Well, they're only sort of slaves in that the Israelis don't want them to work for free. They don't want them there at all. So it's not that they're slaves and that they're forced to work for free all the time. It's just that they have no rights that the Israeli government is bound to respect whatsoever. And they live really worse than people lived under Soviet communism as far as their ability to just travel, take care of their daily business. They are helots. They are 10th class citizens. And the Israelis treat them as such to the fullest extent. One of the things she talks about is the checkpoints and how here you had, she tells the story of a Palestinian woman in labor. She's not even trying to get to an Israeli hospital. She's just trying to get to a hospital in another part of the occupied West Bank. And she gets stopped at the checkpoint and the IDF won't let her pass. And the ambulance gets there, and they hold the ambulance, and they won't let the ambulance take her. Because, hey, the rules are this checkpoint doesn't open till 7 a.m. She gives birth at the checkpoint to twins. They're premature. They need hospital care immediately. And then in their best German accents, the IDF Gestapo of white supremacists
whose fathers are Europeans, say to her, we are just following orders. We, Israeli Jews, IDF soldiers, are just following orders. And they hold the woman and her two premature twin babies at the checkpoint until the babies die. Because the rules are the checkpoint doesn't open till 7 o'clock. Get it? So you see, the Israeli Ashkenazi Jews are white supremacists. They're like the Ku Klux Klan. And they believe that only white people have rights. And they treat even the Sephardic Jews from the region like second-class citizens, as though they were Christian or Muslim and therefore only half a person with no rights at all. It's the melanin content. That's what really gets them. In KKK Israel. So even Israeli citizens of Middle Eastern descent, even Jewish Israeli citizens of Middle Eastern descent are treated as third-class citizens, like the so-called Arab Israelis. But in the occupied West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, they have no rights at all. Here's the Jewish-only road, and here's the Palestinian-only road. Right? Just like in the segregated Old South. And Life in Occupied Palestine, a presentation by a Jewish American, by Anna Baltzer. I was almost done with it. I'll see if I can get her on the show for tomorrow or next week. She talks about the checkpoints. She talks about the separation wall. She talks about all of the racial colonies. She says, only in Hebrew and American English do they use the term settlements. They have their own, she didn't say what the Hebrew word is, but it's a much nicer word than colony, which has built right into it stolen land. Stolen land that belongs to some other human with natural property rights. So they call them settlements, which seems to imply like, geez, there's nobody there. And she shows a map of all of the settlements, so-called, the colonies on the West Bank. And she says, I know it looks like a lot. It looks like, well, geez, you're never going to be able to get rid of those. Except the Israeli government is paying all those settlements, or almost all of those settlers, to be there. And if the Israeli government just withdrew all the welfare, they'd have to come home. So the IDF wouldn't even have to go to the West Bank and force all these people to the other side of the green line, the 67 line. You just stop paying them American tax money. And most of them would have to leave the occupied West Bank. Not all of them. Some of the bigger settlements would be a little bit more of an issue. But the entire project pretty much is subsidized by the American taxpayer by way of the Israeli government. And all they are is land rustlers. And the only argument that you can come up with for me is, oh yeah, well the Americans used to have KKK white supremacy in the South. Yeah, and then we got rid of that. And now we're happy that we got rid of that. And now we're ashamed that that was ever a part of American history. Right? And that's the entire consensus of the entire population of this country, including even in the Republican Party. It was the Democrats then, but the conservatives are, you know, the right are all Republicans now. And you could say, yeah, but America stole all this land from the Indians. Yeah. And the consensus is that we feel bad about that. It wasn't supposed to be that way. Should have never been that way. So it's hardly an excuse for the Israelis to act just like the worst Americans ever acted. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys. Well, it's the Iraq War anniversary. I'm going to get to that in a minute. And I got Trita Parsi coming on to talk about the Iran nuclear talks. But let me talk a little bit more about Palestine here. See if maybe I can get Margulies. Oh, good. Margulies is going to be on at 1:30. Cool. To talk about Israel-Palestine here with us. So here's what I was going to say. Netanyahu has now, and he's supposedly backpedaling, but no, he's not. He has admitted that he never wanted a Palestinian state, that he was lying when he said, oh, yeah, Palestinian state, sure, I'll negotiate a Palestinian state. I'm all about that, at his Bar-Ilan University speech back in 2009. You see, the thing about Benjamin Netanyahu is he's a liar, which means if he ever says anything that sounds good, it's a lie. If he says something that sounds horrible, then you could probably take that to the bank. But when he said, oh, yeah, Palestinian state, I'm for negotiating a Palestinian state, he was lying. All he was saying was, it's easier for me to steal more land if I pretend like I'm going to one day negotiate a deal where I steal less land. Idiot. You see, you Americans are easily moved. It's absurd how easily moved you are. Ha, 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 ha. He laughed. That's a direct quote. That's a direct quote of Netanyahu talking about you and your brain. Oh, you're so easy to push around. It's retarded. But now he's admitted that he was lying all along. That, of course, Likud's doctrine is greater Israel. Likud's doctrine is, as he really admitted a few months back as well, that they will never allow there to be a Palestinian state. That Israel is all the land between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. And the Palestinians who live on the West Bank, they can go drown themselves in the river. As he said in his, I don't know if he even mentioned East Jerusalem at the congressional speech, but at his AIPAC speech, the only even oblique reference to the existence of the Palestinians was a screw them, where he said the entire city of Jerusalem belongs to me. I mean, us. And it will eternally be the undivided capital of Israel. Which means, read between the lines, all the Palestinians who actually own the property in East Jerusalem, they can all go drown in the river. He's going to steal it. He's going to use bulldozers to destroy their property and turn it over to white Jews from Europe. Because he's a white supremacist, like the Ku Klux Klan. Sorry, Klansmen. But yeah, they're all a bunch of white supremacists like you over there in the Likud. Benjamin Netanyahu, he's a white supremacist. And his attitude is all of the Arabs can die. They can starve themselves to death or get starved to death if they're Gazans, I guess. He means to push them all into the Mediterranean Sea or the Jordan River. And I think Gaza, they don't care as much about Gaza. But the West Bank, why, that's Judea and Samaria, which means that in ancient Hebrew mythology, the magic make-believe Yahweh gave it to a bunch of white Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe? Really? Not the actual sons and grandsons and great-great-great-great-great-great-grandsons of Abraham that actually live there? Oh, I get it. See, it's all make-believe nonsense, and so it can mean whatever you want it to mean. See? Yeah, right after God created white Jesus. Oh, wait. I mean, right before God created white Anglo-Saxon Jesus, he created white Anglo-Saxon Ashkenazi Judaism. And granted racial superiority to white people from Eastern Europe over the people who actually live in the land of the ancient Hebrew mythology. Which, of course, is totally not true. They never, for example, the Jews, the ancient Jews, were enslaved in Egypt or any of that stuff. The whole thing is complete nonsense, just like all religion is totally made up nonsense. Oh, we have a magical property right from our magical book of ancient Hebrew mythology, which is just as credible as ancient Greek mythology is. Oh yeah, Poseidon said the whole Mediterranean Sea belongs to me. You see how stupid that is? You see how incredibly stupid that is? No, come on, that's all smoke and mirrors and subterfuge anyway. It's not an ancient biblical magical property, right? It's white supremacy. That's what it is. You know, like in apartheid South Africa. You know, like in that song, Mississippi Goddamn. Like that. And so what Netanyahu now has done, though, is he has pulled the cloak back. Not that it was fooling you or me, but it was serving the politicians of the United States and the European Union quite well, thank you. Oh, the Likud? Yeah, they'll negotiate a Palestinian state someday. Yeah, it's true that they absolutely refused to cooperate with John Kerry's best efforts to create a Palestinian state last year, ending last year. But hey, you know, Netanyahu claims that his official position is that, yeah, someday. Well, not anymore. And I know he's backpedaling on this in his interview with Alan Greenspan's wife on MSNBC, but so what? Only she is stupid enough to believe that. Now the mask is off. Now everyone knows it's as clear as it could possibly be that the Likud party's intention, nay, the majority of the population of the state of Israel's intention, is to steal all of the West Bank from the human beings who live there, who own it. And so, I don't know what's going to change. Probably nothing. But I just got a tweet. I just got a tweet, and I saw a couple of news articles like this earlier about, and this is never going to happen. I can't believe this. But I don't know. I guess it's possible that Barack Obama, they say, is considering going to the United Nations Security Council with a resolution demanding that the Israelis give up the West Bank. It's the end of the peace process and the beginning of a brand new something. But I don't know about that, man. I just don't believe that Obama's got the balls to do it. But maybe he does. I sure would like to see it. You know, the tweet I got says, check out the lady from RT. Supposedly has the full text of the thing. She says here, the White House is now reportedly seriously considering calling for a UN Security Council resolution demanding Israel retreat to 67 borders. I just don't believe that. I don't believe Obama's going to do that. I mean, you show me. Hey, if I'm wrong, then great. I'd love to be wrong, but I don't believe Barack Obama would do such a thing. If Barack Obama was going to do that, he would have backed up John Kerry in his effort over the last year and a half. Well, that ended a year ago, but a year and a half before that. And he refused to do that. And, of course, you know, the Israeli population, they love this stuff. If it's the entire UN Security Council, in fact, if it's every nation state on the planet versus Israel, then great. That just makes them believe in their own lie that much better. That they're that much better than everyone else, and that's why everyone doesn't like them. Right? Just like the Americans. Oh, why do they like us? It couldn't possibly have anything to do with all the human lives we've destroyed with high explosives. It couldn't be the torture it must be that they're jealous of us because we're rich and free. Although I can't really think of any freedoms we have, but same kind of thing there. I don't know. I guess we'll see what happens. But at least the mask is off, so maybe that's progress.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Trita coming up on the question of whether KKK white supremacist Israel will be able to scotch the Iran talks. And then Eric Margolies will be on to talk about whether KKK white supremacist Israel will be able to continue to steal all the West Bank from the human beings who own it. You know, I saw an interview with Rabbi Kane. He was the guy that the first Al-Qaeda attack in America, actually, was the murder of Rabbi Kane. Not that he didn't deserve it. He did. But anyway, hey, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled that he was a fascist, which is a nice way of saying Nazi. So F him. But the now dead Rabbi Kane told 60 Minutes one time, I'm not a Jeffersonian. You can believe in Thomas Jefferson all you want, pal. I don't believe in that. I believe in my tribe. And that means we can kill and steal and do whatever we want to people who aren't members of our tribe. And if you don't like it, screw you. There. That is Israel speaking honestly. Out of the mouths of Rabbi Kanes, who don't give a damn whether you like it or not. And what's the Thomas Jefferson reference? The Thomas Jefferson reference is Jefferson and, you know, his repetition, basically, of John Locke from the Second Treatise on Civil Government in the Declaration of Independence that said every individual human being has just as much divine right as every other one. That our right to own that which we justly acquire is sacred and inviolable. In other words, even if you're a Palestinian, you have the right to own property. So you see how that could be a problem for Rabbi Kane, because his attitude was, I'll kill you and take your land. You don't have a right that I'm bound to respect, said Rabbi Kane. You see how that works? White supremacy, that's what it is. Also known as the most discredited and illegitimate belief system in American society anymore. Well, outside the Republican Party anyway. He said, I don't believe in human rights. I don't believe in Thomas Jefferson and his, you know, I don't agree with Thomas Jefferson and you Americans that every person has rights. I don't believe in that because I'm Rabbi Kane and I say only Jews have rights and everyone else can die while giving their land to me. And so, yeah, back in 1970, whatever, the Israeli Supreme Court called that fascism. That's, they're no longer hiding it. Rabbi Kane now speaks for all of Israel. That is Israeli policy. If you're not a member of their tribe, you can go and get bent. You can go and drown in the sea, or you can drown in the Jordan River, but all your farmland belong to us. And if you resist, we'll kill you. Torture your children. Laugh while your babies die at the checkpoint. Because screw Western civilization. Who said that Israel is Western civilization? They're not. They might be white supremacists, but mostly they're from Eastern Europe, where they never did believe in John Locke. Marx got to him first. Israel is an Oriental society. They're collectivist, tribalists. They reject individual rights. Just look at the numbers. Likud just won in a landslide. So what does that mean for the future of the Palestinians? I don't know. Some Palestinians are saying, great, now there's no more pretension, and now they expect things to get better. I don't. I think what's going to happen is there's going to be a one-state solution, because it already is one state. And then the Israelis are going to realize that they're going to either have a choice, or you're either going to have to let all the Palestinians vote for members of the Knesset, or they're going to have to kill them all. And I think they're going to kill them all. Israeli policy is that brown people aren't human beings, they don't have rights, and they can kill as many of them as they feel like. And their other policy is that they must maintain an 80-20 supermajority state. 80-20. Which means that if they have a bare majority of Palestinians in a single state, then they're going to have to kill them all. They're going to have to kill a few million of them. And they will. Why wouldn't they? Who's going to stop them? Barack Obama? Jeb Bush? I think the Palestinians are in a much worse position now than they were before. Because I think that, seriously, I think if Netanyahu came on TV today and said, everyone, all Arab Muslims and Christians in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, you can either start running toward Jordan or you can get shot for walking too slow. And I think no one would do anything about it. No one would do anything about it. The Europeans wouldn't do anything about it. The Americans wouldn't do anything about it. No one else has the ability to do anything about it. I don't mean to give them ideas, but I think that's what's coming next. Because what are they going to do instead? Become Jeffersonians? Drop the collectivist tribalism in favor of individualism? Right. Anyway. Jeez. Even in America, somebody like Joe Klein, a liberal Zionist like Joe Klein, can say that it's forgivable to be an anti-Semitic racist as long as the Semites you're picking on are Arabs, not Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe who aren't even Semites. You're not even a Semite. The Arabs whose land you're stealing, they're Semites, and you're not. You're a white supremacist from Europe. How the hell did that happen? Bah-ha-ha-ha-ha. Ha. But as Joe Klein writes, many Jews have come to regard Arabs as the rest of the world traditionally regarded Jews. In other words, those many Jews he's referring to, they're a bunch of Ku Klux Klansmen, racist, bigot, anti-Semites. The worst kind of people. Right? Not because they're born that way, but because of the mindset that they choose. And then he excuses them. They have had cause. Oh yeah, it's perfectly reasonable to be a white supremacist, racist, bigot, Klansman as long as somebody from Hamas shot a bottle rocket over his prison wall and it exploded in the middle of a field that, you know, used to belong to a Palestinian before it was taken from him at gunpoint. Boy, I guess you'd be a Ashkenazi Jewish white supremacist too if somebody shot a bottle rocket out over their prison wall at an empty field that their grandfather used to own. Oh, that's totally justified then, huh, Joe Klein? Yeah, white supremacism is perfectly fine as long as it's in favor of a bunch of pretend, not even actual Semites, who are actually mostly a bunch of white people from Europe. Did you ever see that episode of the Joy Bear Show, or that clip? I don't know if anybody saw the whole episode. Did you see that clip of the Joy Bear Show where she's talking with Helen Thomas before Helen Thomas died? And Helen Thomas is saying, yeah, you know, I think that the Palestinians in the West Bank, they have a right to their property. And Joey Bear says, but that's anti-Semitism. And Helen Thomas says, huh? First of all, it's their land. Second of all, You are not a Semite, Joey, Joy. I am a Semite. Right? Helen Thomas was Lebanese. She says, I am a Semite. You are a white person from Europe. So how the hell can me being factually correct about what you do to other people possibly make me an anti-Semite? You don't have any idea what you're talking about, do you, Joy Bear, however you say it, Behar? And the answer was no. She has no idea what she's talking about. A white lady from Europe calling a Semite an anti-Semite for saying it's wrong for white ladies from Europe to steal land from Semites. Yeah, you really thought this through well. Oh, what a waste of a show. I was going to tell you all about The Spies Who Pushed for War by Julian Borger. It's the story of how Israel lied you into war with Iraq 12 years ago. Yeah, Israel did. Ariel Sharon and his agents lied you into war with Iraq 12 years ago. The Spies Who Pushed for War by Julian Borger in The Guardian. And also Agents of Influence by Robert Dreyfuss in The Nation. And they did so because they're stupid. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. That's it. I've had it with this onion. I'm going to come up with something to play for a minute before we come back from the top of the hour news every show. I just can't stand this crap anymore. How in the hell is that funny? How in the hell did that make a single person on this entire planet laugh?
Oh, yeah, the monkeys came up with AIDS because AIDS comes from monkeys. And so, you know what? We should do an onion news report about that, guys. Isn't that hilarious?
I'll wait till you guys are done gut laughing from that hilarious onion news. Are you done? Oh, okay, good. And we can get to our first guest on the show today. It's Trita Parsi from the National Iranian American Council. Welcome back to the show, Trita. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing great. Sorry for making you hold on through that ridiculous crap. So tell me some good news. I want good news.
That's nothing compared to what I'm dealing with here in D.C.
Yeah. Tell me some good news about these Iranian nuclear talks. They're going to get this deal, right?
I'm pretty confident they're going to get a deal, whether they'll get it before the March 31st deadline or whether it will have to wait until then remains to be seen. But they're clearly making progress. They're clearly super dedicated, and they're clearly in the last phase of a negotiation in which there's a lot of haggling and a lot of threats of walking out and things like that, which paradoxically actually is a good sign.
How's that?
Well, because it means that they've entered the last phase of a negotiation. That's always what it is. I mean, you know yourself when you go into a car dealership and you're going to buy a car. Towards the end, that's when you throw out everything you possibly can, but you're doing it because you're not really ready to walk away. You're just trying to get the best possible deal you can.
Right. So it's just, in other words, it's the very last few outstanding issues that still have to be resolved, and everybody's pushing as hard as they can on those, but the rest of the issues are resolved, is what you're saying.
That certainly is the message that is clear from both sides, that they have come a very, very long way, but the last couple of yards or miles is going to be intense. It may not be more difficult, but it's going to be intense, and there's a time pressure right now. There's pressure from Congress. There's pressure from Netanyahu. There's pressure from some Iranian hardliners as well. But overall, everyone you talk to, including critics of this deal, the consensus is that something is going to come out of this.
And now no more extensions, right? This is it.
It's going to be extremely difficult to envision an extension. Now, certainly, they actually have a June or July deadline that is the actual deadline for the final deal. The March deadline is more of an interim deadline for a political framework.
Mm-hmm.
But I cannot see them go beyond July. And if they manage to get a political framework by end of this month, then I think it's very difficult to foresee that the negotiations over the schedule and details and things like that are going to cause this whole thing to break down. By that point, I think we're very, very close to having a complete deal.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, it seems like to me, and I could be wrong about this, but it seems like if they got this deal by the end of this month, and then Obama was to, well, he wouldn't even have to say it. If he got the deal, then the politics in Washington, D.C. would shift toward the president to a huge degree. And it would probably make it much more difficult for the Republicans to get a veto-proof majority on their new sanctions and these kind of things. However, if they only get a part of a political framework of a deal and they're not quite done and they have to wait until July to finish, then that really leaves the door open for more obstruction inside the U.S. Congress, correct?
Absolutely. If there is an interim political framework agreed to right now, then that's going to be a huge tool that the administration can use to calm Congress down and to prevent any other additional negative measures coming out of Congress. And in particular, it will be very clear that any measures that would come out would be partisan measures in the sense that the president may not be able to convince Republicans, who may actually not care about the substance of this issue, but for them it's political. Mm-hmm. But also, even for Democrats who may remain skeptical, it's going to be more difficult to side with the Republicans against their own president. If there isn't any progress, then the president is going to have a very hard time keeping Democrats to his side.
So, in other words, you're saying even if they do just get a political deal, not the final deal, but the political framework done, that's going to really help rather than...
Oh, absolutely. It's going to be huge because also it's going to help the administration starting to talk about what's actually in the deal. Part of the reason why this has been very difficult for the administration to defend is because if they reveal the details of the negotiations, they would in and of itself scuttle the talks. Keeping a very strict discipline about what is leaked and not leaked has been essential to get this far. If they start leaking and explaining things before there actually is a signature on the paper, they actually jeopardize the talks. But once there is a political framework, then they can go out and they can have the president said in one of his interviews, they can go forward and actually make the case not only to Congress but also to the American people, which is something that has been difficult for them to make so far because they essentially been in the debate with one hand tied behind their back.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the Republicans really, though, have no argument whatsoever other than, well, full-scale war and occupation and regime change. I guess I read one thing this morning that said the alternative is not war. The alternative is some covert action and just wait around for the regime to fall like it almost did in 2009. And yet, and I know there have been disagreements about what happened with that election in 2009, but I don't think I ever heard anyone argue credibly that the Ayatollah and the entire state of Iran was in jeopardy of being overthrown. It was just a disputed election for the presidency, but even the leaders of the Green Movement, they weren't anti-Ayatollah. They weren't trying to bring down the regime, correct?
There were elements who would like to go further, but, you know, the actual leadership of that opposition were very much from the regime itself, but they wanted the regime to go in a completely different direction. I think the Republicans or those in the Republican Party who want to portray themselves as some sort of a champions of democratization, a notion that I find quite laughable because wherever they have gone with their militaristic foreign policy, they have not created democracy. They created chaos, ethnic cleansing and everything else. But they still like to pretend that as if they are some sort of a champion for that. But they completely misread. I mean, in fact, I don't think even they read. They just imposed on the Green Movement whatever they wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. It's not at all. I mean, when I did interviews for my second book and I interviewed a lot of the leaders of the Green Movement, they told me that they were just hoping that the United States would be quiet and stay out of this as long as possible because they were afraid that U.S. involvement statements, et cetera, had a greater likelihood of creating problems for them than mm-hmm. creating than actually helping them.
Yeah, of course. It just means that everybody, even if they're not CIA, they're walking around with a giant CIA floating over their head if they're in dissent at all. And meanwhile, the war party in America says we should have done more to help them when all that could have done is made things that much harder for them, obviously.
Absolutely. I mean, and the thing that John McCain, for instance, he went on the floor and said that we should do help them, etc. He did that without ever talking to anyone from that movement that would convey that request. I mean, it was one thing if they had requested that help, but the idea that our help is always welcome, that that's not a question mark about that. It's just an indication of how little they know of the rest of the world.
Yeah. Well, and still, even then, it would have been a dumb move on their part to request help. It'd be as dumb as if you asked the Iranian government to help finance the National Iranian American Council.
Absolutely.
You don't need that baggage.
Exactly. That's a good comparison, because here's a pro-democracy indigenous movement who took tremendous pride in being indigenous and doing this on their own. Now, of course, there were some elements that, as the regime became so violent and so repressive, became a bit desperate and may have said things and slogans, etc., but the leadership remained completely constant and consistent on this issue. They rejected sanctions from the outside world, they rejected involvement, and they really wanted to hold a nationalist card and portray the Ahmadinejad government and the supporters of that as those who truly are selling out the country. In the midst of that, you cannot request help from any country, and particularly not the United States.
Right. All right, now, well, we're real short on time here, but can you just describe real quick the point of your recent piece about how, for the Iranians, their regime could be in real trouble if they capitulate too far here and give in to the Americans? Why is that?
Well, I think something that happened for the administration earlier in 2012, late 2012, early 2013, was a realization that the sanctions track that the administration had embarked on, that was very, very tough sanctions on Iran, actually had a higher likelihood of leading to war than leading to some form of Iranian capitulation. And part of the reason for that was that Ayatollah Khamenei had become, he had lost a lot of his constituencies of support after the 2009 fraudulent election. And the ones that he had managed to keep had, of course, then become all the more important for his continued reign. And they were very hard line, and they would look very, very negatively on anything that smelled capitulation. And this led to an incentive structure for Khamenei to actually fear capitulation more than even a military confrontation with the United States, because he knew he could not survive a capitulation, because he would lose his last constituency of support. Whereas with a war, he knew he couldn't win it, but he could survive it.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that if the U.S. just kept on pushing for more sanctions, which is what some critics of the negotiations right now call for, it would actually lead to a situation in which we would slow walk into a military confrontation, because the other side simply was not going to capitulate.
Right. And now, see, I'm confused about all this, too, about the military confrontation. I know you got to go real quick, but I was talking with Gareth about this, about how, well, if the deal falls apart, we won't necessarily just go back to the status quo, because, we'll be on the other side of a failed deal from here. But on the other hand, there really is no reason to believe, is there, that none that I've ever heard of, that the Iranian government seeks anything more than this capability that, well, maybe one day if they really thought they had to, they could make nukes, but they don't seem to even want to make nukes at all. And so it would take them repudiating the Non-Proliferation Treaty, kicking the inspectors out the way the North Koreans did, and announcing, now we're going to try to make nukes. That's really the only thing that could lead to a real American war against Iran. Otherwise, we go back to just having a safeguarded program, right? What am I missing there?
I'm not so sure. I think if there is a failure of these talks, and again, I don't think they're going to fail. I think they're going to succeed. But if there was a failure of talks, we're not going to go back to the status quo. Because you see, the reason why the voices for war have tended to be much more quiet in the last year and a half is precisely because there's been an ongoing diplomatic process. Once that diplomatic process collapses, the voices of war are going to be very, very loud again, and there's going to be an argument that now we have no choice to go to war because diplomacy has been exhausted and diplomacy did not work.
Mm-hmm.
I personally don't think the current president is particularly keen on taking military action, but I think the next president in his or her first year would face a tremendous amount of pressure to take military action if this issue isn't resolved diplomatically. That is completely separate from whether the Iranians actually would try to build a bomb or not. Those who were seeking war with Iran knew very well
right.
that Iran was not seeking a war. I mean, we know now that the Mossad told the Prime Minister of Israel that the Iranians did not have an active weapons program, and they were not likely to pursue one in the near future. He still went to the UN and everywhere else and talked about an existential threat. So what the Iranians do with their nuclear program is not necessarily what will instigate a military confrontation.
Right. And with that, I know you got to go, but thank you very much for your time, Trita. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's great work you guys do there.
Okay. Thanks.
That's Trita Parsiali. He's at the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org. We'll be right back in just a sec.
Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Coming up, Eric Margolies will be on the show. Yeah, so that was Trita. He's hopeful. Me too. It's just a civilian nuclear program. You know, I think the Hawks would like to see the Iranians go the North Korea route and go ahead and make nukes so they'd have an excuse to attack them. But I don't think they're going to do that. Iranian strategy has been pretty clear this whole time. Stay within the NPT. Put your hands up, open your books up, and let the whole world know. There is no weapons program here, dude. You can look around. Now, what they did with North Korea was they took a perfectly good deal, and then they deliberately destroyed the perfectly good deal. They had a deal, Bill Clinton and Warren Christopher brokered it back in 1994, and what it said was, we'll give you welfare, and we'll give you fuel oil, and we'll give you a light water reactor if you promise to turn off your heavy water reactor that produces weapons-grade plutonium. And the North Koreans agreed. And, you know, the Clinton administration, they never did live up to their end of the deal. They never built the light water reactors, although I think Donald Rumsfeld's company probably got the money for them. They never did build them. They gave them, I think, some money and maybe some of the fuel oil, but they never did give them all the money that they'd promised. And I know it's not the most libertarian thing in the world to pay a bunch of welfare money to North Korea. On the other hand, bribing them to not make nuclear weapons, you know, proportionally, seems like probably not the worst project of the Clinton regime. But then George W. Bush came in and broke the deal. He pretended to believe for a minute this ridiculous lie that the North Koreans had for no reason whatsoever just up and admitted that they had a secret uranium enrichment program that they hadn't told anybody about before then, which there's still no evidence to believe that that was true. And they have a uranium enrichment program now, but there's no reason to believe they had one back in 2002. And but anyway, the Republicans just lied and said, aha, the North Koreans are in violation of the agreed framework. Well, that's it. And George Bush announced, I hate Kim Jong-il. He's a pygmy. Not that Bush is racist against short black folks or anything. He did everything he could to convince the North Koreans to break the deal. Not only did he outright announce that the Americans were leaving the agreed framework deal, but he also announced the Proliferation Security Initiative, which was basically a claim to be able to legally or extra legally seize North Korean boats on the high seas when and if they felt like it, and then added on new sanctions. And then only after the new sanctions, in the spring of 2003, Only then did the North Koreans withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, kick the inspectors out of the country, and start making nukes. And now they've got them. So, you know, really the Iranians have taken the opposite approach all along, which is, you know what? Keep adding your sanctions. Hands up. We got a safeguards agreement for between 2003 and 2005. They had an additional protocol to their safeguards agreement that allowed the IAEA to inspect even more of their facilities. And, well, anyway, I don't know, man. My only point is it's a big fake crisis anyway. It's a civilian safeguarded nuclear program anyway. If our government and their government can't make a deal that simply entails lifting the sanctions in exchange for expanded inspections to make sure that their civilian nuclear program stays one, then I don't know what the hell to tell you. I agree with Trita that I think that Obama really wants this thing. I think he and Kerry are really working on it. And I think politics-wise, it would just be too ugly if he failed at this point. He's got to succeed at something, this president, doesn't he? I mean, other than backing al-Qaeda against Iran's allies in Syria. And so, you know, I don't know. And also, I guess I'm just hopeful because I'm so sick of explaining the civilian nature of Iran's nuclear program and the safeguards agreement and stuff. I could just puke blood at this point. I can't stand it no more. You can't make a bomb out of 3.6% enriched uranium-235, okay? All right, thank you. All right, anyway. Yeah, we'll see what happens. Trita Parsi, Nyack there. Eric Margulies on in just a couple of minutes. Let me just mention to you, Tom Cotton is here in the Washington Post, calls for global military dominance. It's just the Wolfowitz doctrine is all he says here. There should never be any near-peer competitor. No country should ever even be able to seriously consider challenging America's military might. So that's straight out of Toward a Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy by Crystal and Kagan from 1996, Rebuilding America's Defenses from 1997. And, I mean, really, for that matter, the Defense Planning Guidance from 1992. You can read all about it in the New York Times. So, Tom Cotton, when he's not serving the Ayatollah giving Iraq to the Iranians and their sock puppets, he's serving the Israelis and the Likud Party. And a lot of times those are the same thing, as much as they try to deny it. Haven't you ever read How Chalabi Conned the Neocons? Yeah, the Iranians sent Chalabi to tell the neocons that an American war against Iraq would be good for Israel. And that was good enough for them. Who cares if it's good for America, not the neoconservatives? And so anyway, Tom Cotton might be 6.5 feet tall, but really he's just the tiny little bitch of two foreign countries, Israel and Iran, and anti-American to his tiny little pathetic core. Hey, I fought in the Iraq War. Really? So that makes you a tool of the Ayatollah. Tell me more about your heroism, you stupid idiot. Oh, you fought in the Afghan War. That makes you the tool of the Ayatollah too, stupid. My kingdom for video footage of someone confronting Tom Cotton with the reality of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the Dawah Party, the Badr Brigade, and the United Iraqi Alliance. Somebody asked Tom Cotton, who's the Supreme Islamic Council, Tom? Which factions in Iraq do they back? I mean, other than you. All right. Anyway, I'm all out of time, so here's the police state section. Check this out. This is at the Huffington Post. The shocking finding from the DOJ's Ferguson report that nobody has noticed. Out of 16,000 people, no, pardon me, out of 21,000 people in Ferguson, 16,000 have warrants out for their arrest. 16,000 fugitives in Ferguson, Missouri right now. You believe that? Yeah, it's true. That's because you're not free. You live in a totalitarian police state, you stupid idiot. Singing freedom every time you go to a ball game. Freedom? What freedom? Mom calls the cops to give her kid a talking to for stealing. They took the children away for 4 months and locked her in jail. Idiot. And here mom calls the cops. They shoot her son to death for holding a screwdriver.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Boy, everybody on Twitter is just as confused as could be. Oh, and Netanyahu now says that he is in favor of a Palestinian state. Huh. I got Eric Margulies on the line. Hey, Eric, sometimes Netanyahu says that he's in favor of a Palestinian state, and other times he says that he's not. Can you tell which is the truth and which is a lie?
Oh, I can. I've been saying it for years, Scott, that Netanyahu and his right-wing supporters haven't the slightest inclination to create a real Palestinian state. So his comments are addressed in two directions. One to the Americans, which he will continue saying, yes, we'll talk about it, we'll consider it, it's a good thing. And then to the Israeli public, particularly the right wing, saying, never, yet, jamais, a Palestinian state.
And here's what I don't understand, though. How could any American be buying this at this point? He already admitted that he was lying before when he said that he did favor a Palestinian state. Oh, when I admitted I was lying earlier? No, that was a lie. Actually, I was telling the truth in the first place when I said I was going to do the thing that you all know I'll never do and that you just watched me jerk John Kerry around for a year and a half not doing.
Well, unfortunately, we Americans have become used to politicians that lie. So we don't found anything unusual in what Netanyahu is doing.
Crazy. All right, so the New York Times says that Obama is considering supporting a UN Security Council resolution insisting that Israel get the hell back behind the Green Line in 1967. What do you think of that?
Well, the U.S., Obama should have done it a long time ago if he had any real courage. But he hasn't. And so what if the UN, Israel has violated scores of UN resolutions, many of them that were vetoed by the U.S. So Israel will just laugh it off and say, okay, who's going to make me do it? And the answer is no one.
Right. All right. Well, so I wonder what you think is next for the Palestinians. Now that the charade of the peace process is completely over, and now that, well, I don't know, in America maybe they'll believe anything, but in the rest of the world, they're all going to ignore what Netanyahu said to Mrs. Greenspan this morning, and they're going to go with what he said the other day about there never being a Palestinian state. So in a sense, it's kind of a whole new day, especially now that the Europeans don't have that cover of, you know, the European politicians of being able to pretend to believe that there's any kind of actual peace process going on here now. But so, I don't know, I guess like you just said about the UN, still doesn't make any difference to the Israeli government. But what about to the people of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip?
Well, they're in a hopeless situation, Scott. They live under great oppression. I've been there across the whole area many times. They are a totally subjugated people under martial law. The so-called Palestinian Authority, the government that leads them in the West Bank, is a bunch of corrupt crooks. Its leader, Mohammed Abbas, is 80 years old. He's an Israeli stooge, to use simple English. He'll probably be kicked out. Hamas, with the rest of the Palestinians in Gaza, at least they have a government that represents them, but it is totally isolated, particularly now with Egypt in close alliance with Israel and Saudi Arabia. So there, I don't see any hope for the Palestinians. They'll riot, there'll be more intifadas, there'll be more cries of apartheid and things like that, but in the end, the Israelis hold all the cards.
Yeah. So, well, I guess then the only question is slow motion or fast motion ethnic cleansing out of the West Bank?
Well, that has been going on for a long time, and that is the secret Israeli agenda, to make life so miserable for the people on the West Bank and formerly Gaza that they will leave and go somewhere else. They say, well, the Arab world's a big place. Ariel Sharon used to say, well, Jordan is really the Palestinian state. Well, he had a point there. It's 60% Palestinian. But the Palestinians don't want to leave and give up their land. There are 5 million other Palestinians living scattered across the Arab world who are homeless and stateless. And I see absolutely no hope for them.
Man. And then so, well, I guess, back to stupid American politics here. Never mind the Republicans, but I don't know. Like at the last Democratic convention, it was pretty obvious that the leaders of the Democratic Party are completely in the thrall of the Israelis and the Israel lobby. But the grassroots of the Democratic Party, they're liberals, and they tend to believe in silly things like Palestinians have human rights and stuff like that. So I wonder whether you think that, you know, there's any kind of hope for the American political system, one of the other parties becoming, you know, even slightly good on this?
No, I definitely don't. The Israelis have now 100% full ownership of the Republican Party, thanks to the Israel lobby and also to this Christian Zionist movement. The Republicans, and these are not the Republicans of yore, my kind of Republicans on the East Coast. These are heartland Republicans who have rely on religious votes. 44% of Republican voters are born-again Christians who believe in Armageddon, and it's important to recreate biblical Israel so the world can be destroyed. It's a powerful movement. The Democrats are pretty well controlled by Mr. Chaim Saban, an Israeli billionaire, mm-hmm. who's a major backer funder of Hillary Clinton, who is going to be probably the only candidate for the Democrats at this point. So the grassroots have very little to say on this issue.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I remember back in the late 1990s, I think maybe when she was running for Senate the first time, Hillary got in a lot of trouble for even using the phrase Palestinian state. Remember that? Whoa, Hillary. Whoa, whoa, whoa. You're way out ahead of American politics here to use that phrase out loud.
It's the only good thing I ever heard her say.
And she backed right down, too.
She was taken to the woodshed and never dared say anything again. Just the way what was really amusing was when Governor Christie of New Jersey made a pilgrimage to kiss the feet of casino mogul Adelson in Las Vegas. He used the term occupied West Bank. And for that, he was vilified by the Adelson supporters. He was sent off into the night and told that you only use the word Samaria and Judea. You never use the word occupied West Bank. He was badly hurt.
Amazing. That's such a funny story how he had to go back to the back office and apologize and all this.
Pathetic. It reminds me of the Stalinist days in the Soviet Union when silly little things like that. In fact, one of my favorite stories is about how a man stopped clapping for Stalin that I heard in the Soviet Union. It was never seen again. Well, we just read about some senators when Netanyahu came, who were seen to applaud him and jump up and wave their arms with insufficient vigor. Mm-hmm. So we're back in the days of Stalin.
Yeah. Yeah, it was Rand Paul who got called out for that. And what was funny was there were plenty of clips of him being as excited as he could possibly be, but you could always find a clip of anyone at a speech like that looking bored for a second. And boy, do they go after him for insufficient fealty to the leader of a foreign power there. Amazing. And of course, for anyone to claim Rand has insufficient fealty to Israel means that they must be completely illiterate or living under a rock, because there's no one more loyal to Benjamin Netanyahu and his goals than Rand Paul. Back in a second.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, sorry, guys. I'm trolling this New York Times idiot. New York Times idiots. I love Twitter. Hey, I'm Scott. I'm talking with Eric Margolies, man. He's the author of War at the Top of the World, An American Raj, Liberation or Domination. Sorry, I didn't give you a good intro at the beginning of this thing, Eric. He writes at UNZ.com, that's UNZ, UNZ.com, as well as LouRockwell.com and his own website, EricMargolies.com. And now, so let me ask you about BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. And this is an effort on behalf of, I guess, private parties mostly in Europe and the United States to boycott Israel and to convince universities, local and state governments, and whatever corporations and whoever else they can influence to divest from Israel. Do you think that that's really hurting, or do you think that, you know, maybe now with this blatant new reality of Netanyahu's avowed statement that there will never be a Palestinian state, do you think that it'll help build up the BDS movement, that then it could maybe have more of effect later?
Scott, I have no doubt that Israel is very concerned by this boycott movement, because it's reacting, and its henchmen in the U.S. are reacting so violently to the issue, going after people who support it. But in the end, it's not going to force Israel to do anything that it does not want to do, for two important reasons. Israel has dominates the French government, and it obviously gives marching orders in Washington and in New York on Wall Street. And as long as it dominates the U.S. and France, nobody's going to force Israel into the same isolated position that happened to South Africa. South Africa had no major supporters abroad, and half-hearted support from Britain, but that was it. The case is entirely different, and the Israelis can ride out any kind of boycott.
Because they have the American taxpayer to suck off of, is that it?
They have that. They have a pretty good economic situation in Israel. Their arms and tech exports are rising, and Israel has found very large deposits of gas in the Mediterranean between Cyprus and the coast of Israel, which Israel is claiming to belong to Israel. No mention of the Palestinians who should be sharing it. So Israel thinks, you know, all signs are golden for Israel for the time being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I was just talking with, I think it was Michael Schwartz about that natural gas, and he was saying that this is really kind of going back to, I guess, 2005. This is part of the reason why Ariel Sharon decided to pull the Israeli colonists out of the Gaza Strip and turn it into a maximum security prison, was to, you know, further prevent them, isolate them, in order that the Israelis might steal all their natural gas and that they would never have the opportunity to. Because I guess they had already started cutting deals with companies to begin to exploit that gas down there, and the Israelis had to figure out a way to stop it.
Yes, and the Israelis have all kinds of under-the-covers deals going with Cyprus and with Greece. So over the Mediterranean gas issue, it will bring them eventually into confrontation with Turkey, but the Turks are pretty cautious at this point.
Mm. Well, and plus they're working so closely together to support Al-Qaeda in Syria right now. It seems like, you know, the Israelis and the Turks, they can work out their differences.
One would think so.
Yeah. Yeah, so now let me ask you this, and I don't know, I guess maybe it's kind of a stupid question. I understand that war is the health of the state, and having enemies is the health of any group of politicians. Look, they're out to get us, that kind of thing. And yet it seems like, you know, there's a point where obviously war is the health of the state unless you lose, or maybe, you know, stealing is the health of your state until all of humanity decides that your state is just a completely illegitimate white supremacist group of land rustlers. And I wonder how long that image can serve Israel. I mean, in theory, they want their nation state to last for, what, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years on into the future, right?
Right.
So isn't that problematic if everyone hates them because they are outright criminals? They're just a nation of criminals, of white supremacist land rustlers and natural gas thieves.
Well, that's not what the American public believes, or much of the European public. There's still great sympathy for Israel. Every time a Holocaust film comes on TV, it generates more publicity. Every time the Arabs commit some kind of dastardly attack, it boosts up Israel. So, recent survey, I was horrified to read that Americans, for their news, they trust Fox News more than anything else. Well, I mean, people who suck up news from Fox are guaranteed to be misinformed and wrong-headed.
Yeah, they even have scientific studies that show that. and yeah, it's amazing because, you know, it's funny about that. Maybe Americans just by and large don't pay attention to the news at all anymore, because I read on one hand, Fox News is way out ahead of all the other TV news. And on the other hand, their average viewer is 76 years old or something like that. So what about the other 300 million Americans? None of us are watching news anymore?
No, interest in foreign affairs has gone way down. Until there's another 9/11 or something like that, it'll boost up. But Americans are shockingly uninformed when it comes to the rest of the world. We are geographically illiterate. Look at this ludicrous example of this two-bit senator the other day. His name escapes me now.
Cotton.
Cotton, that's it. Thank you. Who said on TV, you know, thunder is warning, be careful, the Iranians are moving in on Tehran.
You know, somebody tweeted me yesterday and said, Scott, did you make a mistake? Did you mean to say that? It sounds like you screwed up. I said, no, man, really. Google it. It was Cotton who said it, not me.
Such are the morons that we elect to Congress. And he's one of Adelson's golden-haired boys.
Yeah. Yeah, Bill Kristol's little sock puppet. And, of course, an Iraq war veteran where he successfully helped the Ayatollah steal Baghdad from the Sunnis who lived there and install the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council and the Badr Brigade killers in power there. Of course, I'm sure he doesn't have the first clue about who he was fighting for in the Iraq war or the Afghan war, for that matter. This guy,
he was fighting the bad guys. That's all he knows.
Yeah, there you go. Hey, by the way, here's something that you know about, and I've been hearing accusations like this, and I wonder what you'd say. The Houthis have, I don't know, sort of kind of more or less taken over Sana'a now. We've talked about them for years, the Shiite rebellion from the north of Yemen. They've now regime change, the what was left of the old Saleh regime there in Sana'a or Sana'a, or however you say it. But so if you listen to the war party tell the story, Iran has just taken over Yemen, because if the Houthis are Shiites, then that means they're the sock puppets of the Iranians. But here's my thing. I don't really know that's not true. What about you?
Yemen is an unbelievably complicated place. I've been going there for many years. And I loved it because it was just, it always looks like it's just creeping into the 11th century. in a real Arabian Nights thing. It's very tribal society. It's like Afghanistan. It's not just tribes, but clans who are fighting each other and intriguing. And yeah, the Houthis are on the up. No, they're not sock puppets for the Iranians, even though the Iranians may be giving them some arms and support. The report just came out yesterday, Scott, which is absolutely unbelievable that our government has given $500 million to the U.S.-backed puppet regime in Sana'a, it's gotten lost. Nobody knows where it's gone. It's gone walkabout. Mm-hmm. And most of it, they think, has gone to anti-American groups like Al-Qaeda and other assorted wild men. What an embarrassment. It's incredible. We evacuated our embassy in Yemen, and everything's up for grabs there. I don't think Iranians are going to take over. I think just the wild and crazy Yemenis are going to continue shooting up the place.
Yeah, boy, it looks like if you ask the war party in D.C., it's Al-Qaeda versus the Houthis, and the Houthis are the bad guys because they're backed by Iran.
They're badder than Al-Qaeda, right?
Yeah. Hey, why not? As long as you're a trader, you make a lot of money working in D.C. these days, apparently. Thanks so much for time. I can't believe we're already out of it, but we are. Eric Margulies, everybody.
Cheerio, Scott.
Thanks.